On this episode of Blue Dot, if you're 20 years old or less, there's never been a time in your life that the United States hasn't had rovers on the surface of Mars. I talked to project scientist Matt Golombek, who's been involved in nearly every U.S. mission to Mars. It's all new and all blue. Join us. Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. This week I talked to Matt Golombek, the project scientist for the Mars Pathfinder mission from 1997. The lander and its tiny rover Sojourner were featured in the film The Martian, when astronaut Mark Watney, played by Matt Damon, uses the long-dormant robots to communicate with Earth. While that was fiction, the real story of exploring Mars has been going on for the U.S. for decades, and Matt Golombek has been at the center of nearly all of it, helping to pick out and evaluate landing sites for all U.S. rover missions. In addition to being project scientist for Pathfinder, Golombek was also the project scientist for the Mars exploration rovers Spirit and Opportunity, which landed on the Red Planet in 2003. Matt Golombek, welcome to Blue Dot.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, I always like to start with origins. When did you first get interested in science in general and then Mars in particular?
So I got interested in geology because I wanted to know why there were mountains and why there were valleys and how the Earth's surface got to be the way it is. And then down in old planetary seemed even cooler because you were worried about how the planetary surface got to be the way it was.
Were you interested in science as a child?
Yeah, I'm generally interested in science and math and sort of did extra courses in high school and then sort of started to concentrate a little bit more so in college.
Briefly, tell me about your path. How did you wind up at JPL?
Circuitous and fortunate and accidental. I have a undergraduate degree in geology and a PhD in geology and geophysics. I spent 2 years as a postdoc, and then JPL offered me a job. At that time, I was a structural geologist, and I spent part of my time doing structural geology on Earth and part on planets, and JPL was kind of a good mix because it does both of those things. I worked at JPL for a bunch of years, and various missions that were in development needed science advising about what sort of things Mars was like. And I got involved in that, and it became very clear to me that we were in a situation where we had no new information on Mars for about 20 years, and our explanations and science was getting stale, in my view, and we needed some new information, and so Pathfinder came along, and it was such a joy to work on a project where you were building real hardware and actually going to Mars. So that's how I got involved.
And so was that the very first Mars mission you were involved in, or were you involved with the Viking landers at all?
I was a guest investigator as a graduate student on Viking. And like I said, that was quite some time before.
1976, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was a graduate student in 78. Interesting story. I actually came out to JPL, to the project office. And I still remember there weren't too many scientists here by then. The mission was in the extended mission phase. And the engineers would be asking me, like, where should we image on Mars? And I'd go say, well, I'm really interested in this area. And then, you know, a week later, back then, the images came down on a television. You could see them. And there were these pictures of areas on Mars I was interested in. I said, whoa, how cool is this? You want some pictures on another planet, and they come in a week. that's totally cool.
Wow. Let's talk about Pathfinder at 20 years old, just this last July 4th, right?
Yeah, it's amazing I'm old enough now.
Well, let's talk about that mission, because it was really a pretty small scale, budgetary-wise mission, wasn't it?
Yeah, the entire mission cost less than the movie you did not see called Waterworld, which was between $200 to $300 million. That's roughly what expensive Hollywood movies cost. And yet, when you look back now, 20 years later, I mean, we were the pathfinder for the Mars exploration program. The technology that we developed in that small amount of money, the computer operating systems, the landing system, the way we operate rovers on the surface, we still use virtually all of those things in many ways and shapes, all from this little teeny weeny little mission that didn't even have science in its name.
And that was the first time you used landing bags, airbags, to land on the surface and bounce along, right?
Yeah, that's the first time. When we were studying it, it was originally a pathfinder for what was going to be a network mission in which we would land 10 to 20 small stations on Mars that would have weather stations and seismometers to measure the internal activity and the atmospheric comings and goings. And we were looking for a low-cost method to land on the surface that could be replicated inexpensively. And the idea of airbags without complicated thruster rockets and control systems seemed like a less expensive alternative than landing on legs.
And at the time, was that a pretty radical idea?
Completely radical. I remember during development, every time I would show pictures of the airbags bouncing along, people would, and they look at the landing sequence. It was the first time we entered the Mars atmosphere directly from the Trans-Mars injection from Earth. All other landers prior went into orbit first. And that was completely radical and different and new. We were coming in much faster, more energy than previous missions, and we were using a completely untested and untried technology, looking for a robust system.
Let's talk about the rover Sojourner, because if we go back from the present, the Curiosity rover, it's about the size of a minivan, right?
Yeah.
And then the two rovers that you've been involved with, Spirit and Opportunity, are large golf cart size?
Yeah, golf carts, yeah.
And then tell us about Sojourner.
Sojourner was the size of your microwave oven. So you can see we've grown in size each time. But in fact, the technology of a six-wheeled rover with what's called a rocker bogey suspension system is exactly the same. And the way we operate those rovers and the images that we use and the operating system are all pretty much exactly the same as what we used with Sojourner. So it was a pathfinder. You can't imagine that there would be a Spirit and Opportunity without Sojourner. And you certainly can't imagine a Curiosity without a Spirit and Opportunity. And I suspect you can't imagine a Mars 2020 rover, which is in development now, without a Curiosity. So it all started with Sojourner and Pathfinder.
And then you just kind of scale up and refine the designs.
Scaled up and got bigger, refined the design. Certainly carried more payload and more instruments to learn more, have greater mobility now because the rover's bigger, so it can cross over larger obstacles and stuff like that. But the basic concept and design is all inherited.
What were some of the principal scientific accomplishments of the Pathfinder mission?
So it was a technology demonstration. So it didn't really have. It wasn't a science mission in that regard, but it did do some fundamental science. And in sum total, it gave us hints of the utility of using a mobile rover to do geology on the surface. The two previous missions were stationary landers, and it was pretty tough to ferret out the geology of the landing sites just from those fixed landers. You can only look at things from one direction. You can't change your point of view. You can't move to a new location that shows something different. With Pathfinder, we didn't explore a huge area. It was hundreds of square meters, but it was enough to give us views of rocks up close that we never could have seen from the fixed lander by itself. And there were tremendously intriguing results to suggest that Mars was much more like the Earth in its distant past than it was like the Moon. The Moon, of course, is dry and desiccating, has never been anything but. But Mars had hints from previous data and really from Pathfinder to suggest that the early history, well, it might have been warm and wet. And that provided the interest level, if you will, for continuing the exploration. If it was wet, maybe life could have started there because water is the absolute requirement for life as we know it. So again, it was the Pathfinder for the science that would continue later. And really, if you think about the public reaction, it was without question the most popular Mars mission ever. It basically brought the internet. It was the most popular internet event at its time in history. It practically brought the internet to its knees. There were so many people wanting to see the images. And back then, news was on newspapers, and we had front page newspaper coverage for over a week. And there's no other planetary mission that's accomplished that since.
And back then, of course, is July of 1997. You're listening to Blue Dot, and I'm your host, Dave Sloan. We're talking to Matt Gollenbeck. He's the project scientist for the Pathfinder mission and also the Mars exploration rovers. We have the Apollo 11 landing site is known as Tranquility Base. There's also a name for the Pathfinder spot, isn't it?
The Sagan Memorial Station. It became NASA reserved the right to name the landers after significant folks, and that was the name of our lander after it had done its job.
And Carl Sagan, of course, had just passed away just prior to that.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about also the mission in pop culture, because it played a prominent role in the book and the movie The Martian. How did you feel about that when you saw your rover and your lander on the big screen?
You almost have to go back. If you look prior to Pathfinder, there were very few, you know, modern Hollywood motion pictures that included, you know, space and Mars. And right after Pathfinder, there were two major motion pictures that were produced by Hollywood studios. And that was a true indication that Mars had gotten into the popular culture. Those movies, one was Mission to Mars by Disney, the other was, I think, The Red Planet. And they both had moderately successful runs, and they showed that popular culture was, you know, they were popular. People were thinking about Mars. The Martian was just the latest example. There have been ones in between as well. Awful cute that he used the Pathfinder rover in a very inventive way. And, of course, that was fun to see.
And he actually used it to be able to communicate back to Earth.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Would that be possible at all?
I mean, first of all, it's a fictional movie, right? So it's a fictional movie, and it was a great fictional movie. And that's the way it should be viewed. No, the Pathfinder lander and rover have been inoperable for quite some time. It would be virtually impossible to resurrect them.
Let's pretend it would be possible.
And that's what makes science fiction fun, right?
That's right. Well, I loved seeing, because I love the Pathfinder mission. In fact, I have a poster of Pathfinder that's been in my classroom. I'm a science teacher for many years, and I always like to point out the red soil and explain the oxidation of iron, and that's why it's, you know, that's why it's red, and see the little rover in the distant picture. It's one of my favorite posters in my room.
Yeah, awesome.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Sloan. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mars Pathfinder and Exploration Rovers project scientist Matt Gollenbeck. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return to my interview with NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory Mars Rover's project scientist, Matt Golombek.
You're a geomorphologist, and I find that a fascinating term. Could you explain to us what is a geomorphologist?
I really classify myself as a planetary geologist, but a geomorphologist is someone who, and I do geomorphology on Mars, so it's a fair question. Someone that worries about how the landforms get to be the way they are. So think back to my initial interest in getting into science, why the mountains were mountains and valleys were valleys. So geomorphology is typically someone who is looking at what's called physical geology, the erosional mechanisms that occur on Mars, the depositional mechanisms, how the surfaces get to be that way, that sort of stuff. And what's interesting and intriguing now that we're studying Mars with all of the instruments that we have been for the past 20 years is that you can use the same basic principles that we have for geomorphology on Earth on another planet. It's just that certain factors are a little bit different there. So on Mars, I would say right now, aeolian activity or wind from the atmosphere interacting with small sand and dust-sized particles are really what's producing the most changes on the surface today. We know there are sand dunes that are active today and moving across the surface. Whereas on the Earth, liquid water pretty much rules the basic erosional mechanisms that we have here on Earth. And so it's truly interesting to compare the efficiency of those two different mechanisms and how they differentially shape the surface. And perhaps even more as interesting in that back in the ancient past on Mars, it looks like water was much, much more active and much more a strong erosional agent than wind was back in those times.
And how long ago was that?
Oh, 3 billion years to maybe 3.6, 3.7 billion years ago. So a long time ago. But that's about the time when we have clear evidence for life beginning here on Earth. And the absolute requirement for life as we know it is liquid water. And thus, in a scientific manner, you can address perhaps one of the most compelling questions that we can ask. Are we alone in the universe? Will life form anywhere that liquid water is stable? Or do you need a one in gazillion chance occurrence? And that's us.
Comparing and contrasting the two planets, Earth and Mars, what are some things that are some striking similarities between the two worlds? And what would you say are some of the striking differences?
So similarities, there are large volcanoes on Mars that are very similar to, say, the Hawaiian volcanoes, large basaltic shield volcanoes, lots of volcanism that's very similar to plains volcanism here on the Earth, and lots of similarities there. We do not have plate tectonics on Mars. Plate tectonics on the Earth is the way that the Earth recycles the volatiles and maintains a clement climate. Without plate tectonics to get the volatiles back into the atmosphere and the oceans, the planet would have dried up. And Mars doesn't have that recycling. Any recycling between the interior and the surface is much, much slower. And that could be a partial explanation for why Mars is a dry and desiccating planet today compared to the Earth.
And volatiles would be substances that are easily evaporated, right?
Yeah, the most important ones for life, of course, water is the dominant one, but water also has lots of ways to move around organics, and organics is how you build life. And so that's all sort of a fundamental connection.
Could you give us your perspective, since you've been involved since the very beginning, really, of Mars exploration with NASA? What are some of the striking things that we know now that we didn't know as of 20 years ago when Pathfinder first landed?
So when Pathfinder landed, we didn't know almost anything about what the planet was made of. What kind of material, what kind of rocks are on the surface? And that's a key for geologists. If you can identify the rock and the mineral, you can identify the environment and the way in which that rock formed. So think of these rocks as tracers of the former environment on the planet. And if you can read those rocks, you can read the past history. And that's what we do as geologists. And we had no idea what sort of materials were on Mars. And that's what Pathfinder went to do with its small rover and its chemical analysis instrument to determine the chemistry and the dominant kinds of rocks. And that's progressed dramatically from that state of almost no information to now we know that there were water-processed rocks that were deposited on Mars back in the Noachian prior to about 3.6 billion years ago. That suggests a neutral pH, water that you could have drank or drinked if you liked at that time, which then progressed into a much more acid-rich watery state in the later periods, and then to a dry and desiccating environment. And that's the overall story that the Mars program has put together and has focused our ability with both rover missions and subsequent orbiters to determine those kinds of early environments, what kind of materials were present, and whether or not the materials needed to start life existed at the time. And our suggestions from our 20 years of Mars exploration is everything you needed was there. There were wet environments with standing bodies of water, and all of the ingredients you needed to start life existed. So now the fundamental question that we'd love to be able to answer, did life start on Mars? And if it did, what happened to it? And if it didn't, why not? What makes us so darn lucky?
I keep thinking it would be great if you could have bottled a bunch of that water and, you know, we could market it right now and you and I could get rich on our Noachian bottled water from Mars.
That would certainly be as good as Fiji water, right?
3 billion years shelf life. Of course, you just mentioned the big question is, did a life ever arise on Mars? Is there perhaps microbial life subsurface today? When do you think we'll really have a chance to answer that question?
Such a compelling question, but a difficult one as well. I mean, if you go looking for it now, it could be a needle in a haystack search. Where do you go look? We don't know. Getting down beneath the surface in a groundwater system on Mars would be tremendously difficult. Drilling is really hard to do. And drilling down to kilometers depth is even more difficult. Most of our exploration has been focused on the ancient Noachian period to understand the rocks that formed in that environment and use those rocks to tell us whether the environment was suitable or not. And so it's going to be a really hard thing. It may require returning samples from Mars, which is a very difficult task to do. And not just any old grab samples, but a sequence of stratigraphically placed samples that form a cache of rocks that are related to each other so you can track how the environment changed with time. To collect those, you need to then get them off the surface of Mars. The kind of scenarios that are being talked about is to collect those rocks and put them in a cache on the surface. Neville Mission goes and picks up that cache and puts it into a capsule and launches that capsule off of Mars into orbit around Mars. And then a third mission would go and collect that capsule and bring it back to Earth. And then once you got it back to Earth, you'd need to build the facility that would keep it completely separate from all the Earth's biota until you determined whether there was anything living there or not. And well, all of those are big ticket items and would be very expensive. So it may take us a while to answer that question.
But there's also the possibility of finding fossilized microbes, isn't there?
Yes, both of those are chances. And I would say the chance of determining it was a fossilized life and it formed by life remotely might be very difficult. You might need to take pieces of the fossil and determine whether it had indications that it was formed by life versus inorganic processes. That might be very difficult to do in situ and may again require samples returned from Mars.
What's your favorite part of your job that you get to do nearly every day?
My dominant research interest, which goes from selecting landing sites and in fact being the navigator for rovers over long distances. We helped determine the path that Opportunity took from Victoria Crater to Endeavour Crater through some terrain that was would have been incredibly difficult driving. And so we chose a path that would be easier to drive and easier to go. And most of that goes to using the remote sensing data that we get from orbiters to infer the surface materials and properties and topography and slopes that would actually be there on the surface if you were a lander or a rover. That's really what site selection is all about, is inferring to the best of your ability what the surface is like and whether it's suitable for landing and roving. And the most fun part for me, without question, is planning a pathway through a terrain that we've never been at before. And the next day, having the rover do that traverse, and at the end of the day, it provides images of a place that you've never seen from the surface at that scale before. And that's, without question, is the most fun part, because you get to discover that surface, the first human eyes from the surface looking out at it, and you've inferred what you think it will be from orbit, and you get to compare that and compare that hypothesis right there in real time. And that's my favorite part of the job.
That does sound fun. Well, we're out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today. I know you're very busy.
And my pleasure to be here and continue all your great work.
Thank you. And Matt Gollenbeck, I hope you get to explore Mars from Pasadena for another 20 years.
Me too.
Thanks to our guest, Matt Gollenbeck. He joined us from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena via Skype. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Thanks to our communications coordinator, Casey Gardner. Follow us at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom. Our theme, Big Wave Dave, was composed and performed by Matt Schultz of New York City. Our co-producer and engineer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.